the past 20 years, the field of animation has exploded, financially and critically. One of the individuals behind this movement is Max Howard, president of Exodus Film Group. As part of the Distinguished Speaker Series, Howard visited Collin College to discuss innovation in animation. Howard graciously stopped to talk with the CougarCast about where animation has been and where it's gone.
We are sitting here with Max Howard. He's the president of the Exodus Film Group with many years in the film business and starting out in theater. And we're so happy to have you talking with us.
I'm very happy to be here.
What has excited you the most about the animation field in the last decade?
I think it is it's CGI, so computer graphics animation, but it's not necessarily for the reason that you might think it is. It's not the look. It's what computer graphics allows you to do, because let's just think back to 2D animation. And essentially, you've got a piece of artwork that you're going to photograph, and you're going to photograph the characters in front of that piece of artwork, so you can't really move the camera. But if people remember Beauty and the Beast, it was the first time we did move the camera. We created a three-dimensional environment and then moved the camera around. It was staggeringly exciting and fantastic. But then for the next few years, we started making more and more films with three-dimensional digital worlds, but with two-dimensional drawings. So you had sort of this clash going on, because you've got because 3D is a reality, and drawing is an illusion. So you've got, so it caused many, many production problems, not least of which is that the drawings, in terms of the complexity, had to be quite simple because they were drawn, whereas the sets could be quite elaborate. And then when we transitioned to CGI, you've got computer characters, model characters, truly three-dimensional characters, which you can move the camera. But once you can move the camera, you can make films in the same way as a live-action filmmaker will make films. And allowing camera moves and going around things really, I thought, was a genuine leap forward in filmmaking.
Do you see cell-drawn animation like they use with Princess and the Frog coming back, or do you see the computer animated features being more the standard?
Well, Princess and the Frog is really interesting. I mean, I wish it had been a more successful film. I thought it was a marvelous gesture that John Lasseter did. This is John Lasseter, started Pixar, you know, great grounding in Disney, traditional Disney animation, you know, went to CalArts, you know, eventually comes back with Pixar and becomes the head of animation. You know, the CG guy comes in and takes over Disney creatively in animation. One of the first things he did was make a 2D film. I thought it was a fantastic gesture, because what he was saying really was, it's, you know, great storytelling has nothing to do with technique. And many of us have always thought that Toy Story is a great film. It had nothing to do with the fact it was CGI, really. It would have worked brilliantly in 2D. I mean, being said, you know, the moving of the camera aspect, I think is fantastic. What I hope with 2D or stop motion or any of the other animation techniques is that filmmakers can sit down and say, what's the best way to tell this story? And I think sometimes it is hand-drawn animation. There's something about the squash and stretch of that. It is a technique. It's a style all its own. And I think it's perhaps a style of filmmaking. We could think about making a black and white film or color. There's certain things you see a great black and white movie, even today. Something about contrast, about the lighting, that is really, you know, phenomenal. So I'm hoping that it's here to stay. But Princess and the Frog didn't do quite the business that people were expecting. I thought it was, it's very easy for someone like me in hindsight. I had nothing to do with it. I'm a long time gone from Disney. I love the company. But when you're sitting on the outside, it's very easy to say, that was the wrong release date. I genuinely think it was the wrong release date, but obviously they thought about it hard, and they're smart people and don't normally make mistakes. But I thought that that was not a Christmas movie. I thought it got squeezed with Christmas Carol. And when the great Super Bowl we had this year in New Orleans played, you thought, well, why wasn't it released at Mardi Gras? Why wouldn't you release it then? But that's an outsider. I'm sure somebody must have talked about it. Fiscally, it had to be released last year. You got money tied up, whatever it may be. But I felt that it didn't do the business it should have done, because it was well-reviewed, very well-liked. I know the merchandising, the consumer product side of it, is doing incredibly well. And I don't think Disney would say for one moment it's not a successful film. But I think those of us thought that it could have been more successful than it was, expected to be more so.
You've mentioned storytelling quite a bit already. In your opinion, do you think that storytelling is more of an asset in the animated feature, maybe more so than it is with a live-action feature where you're dealing with actors and kind of the cult of personality, whereas the animated film is kind of just cut down just a story?
I think it has to be the same. There's no doubt about when I go to pitch an animated film, I can't talk about film stars. I have to sort of, you know, think about this rabbit playing this, whereas I might say, you know, think about Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. I have to say, well, think about a rabbit and think about a bear or something. So I don't have the same sort of tent poles sometimes, but I think story is story. I think the building block of anything is the story. And if you get that right, everything else blossoms from that foundation. I see it as the foundation. I see it equally in live action and in animation.
You got your start in the theater before you got into animation, directing plays. And I was wondering, from a standpoint visually, from a director's perspective, what was the transition like going from dealing with a stage versus dealing with a cell or a piece of animation?
It was extraordinary, actually, and it still is. You do a play, right? You all gather together, you rehearse, you tear the script apart, and you work together, and then you know next Thursday the curtain's going up, right? The audience are coming, they bought their tickets, you're not ready, it all happens so fast, and there's a relationship that's with that audience that's just so immediate, and a chemistry. That chemistry in animation doesn't really exist. I often say to people, you know, the same with live action, you know, when you're on a set and everyone's making a film together, there's a lot more interaction between the talent. But if an animation director was to use the word action, which of course he never does, what would actually happen was that everybody would get up and leave the room, right? You go to your workstation, you go to your computer or your desk, you pick up a drawing, you do a background. What I then realized was the magic of animation is that it is a collective art form. And if you do go to a premiere of a film and you've got the whole crew, you know, a couple of thousand people, 500 people, however many people worked on the film, and you stop that frame of film and on one frame, 1/24th of a second, and you stopped it, and you turn to all the crew and you said, okay, who worked on this frame? 20, 30, 40 people would stand up. And I think, you know, no one person can make these films and can do it. So I love that. But also, I'm able to list to you, you know, a very gracious introduction that you gave me, and, you know, managed to work on a lot of what have become famous animated films. Those films have transcended time, as indeed you and I could have a conversation about Snow White, made in, 1939. We could talk about Bambi, 1941 or 1942, Pinocchio, all these films, you know, even before I was born, right, were made. And yet they're part of our culture, and they're part of an international culture. So these animated films transcend time, which has, for me, given me that moment of an extraordinary realization of how powerful animation can be. If you get one right, if you get these films right, they'll, you know, you'll show them to your kids, and your kids will show them to your kids. And it was that moment for me when I took my daughter to see a re-release of 101 Dalmatians, not the live-action remake, but a re-release in the theatre, 1991, 92. My daughter was probably 3 or 4 years old. She's sitting there, edge of her seat, glued to this film. It's fantastic. It's actually in an old-fashioned format. I think it's not in 1/8:5. I'm not even sure. No, it should have been, really, because it was in 1960 or 61. But anyway, it's a film that I can remember my parents taking me to see. So there am I, and I suddenly got goosebumps because I looked at her looking at the film and thought about that she might take her children to see a film that I've worked on. And it won't be, oh, let's go and see Granddad's film, you know. It's this film could genuinely entertain her kids and a real legacy. And I thought, oh, wow, you don't get that in live action. You don't get that in the theatre. And my memories of the theatre, I'm a theatre, you know, I've got the theatre in my blood. My father was an actor, I go way back in it. But this idea that you're working on these films that live on beyond their sell-by date, and live action films do not, you know, very rare, it's not fair to say they do not, rarely do they. You know, but normally, even if they're a classic, you can place them in the period with which they were made. You can place Citizen Kane and Casablanca Gone with the Wind, you know, they're wonderful, wonderful pieces of work, but they're placed, whereas animated films appear to be timeless. And certainly to kids, they have no, you know, if you and I sat here now and tried to list all the Disney films in order, and you guys, you know, you seem as though you're pretty, you know your animation history and you're well-versed in this. We would both struggle after a while. And I'd probably get a few more right. I should, you know. Mm-hmm. But I'll get some wrong. I'll get the order wrong. I'll get Snow White. I'll get Sleeping Beauty the wrong side of Cinderella or something like that, you know. But pure fact that we could be talking about films made in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, you know, incredible.
Speaking of the way that Snow White is considered now to be a classic in filmmaking in general, just not animated, but animated films have always found some critical success. You worked with Beauty and the Beast, and that received an Oscar nomination. But it seems like over the last maybe 5 years, there seems to be one or two animated films that gets really great critical acclaim, from WALL-E and Up and Ratatouille. Do you think that the perception of animated films has changed from a critical point of view, or do you think there's just better animated films being made? And also, if you can talk about the balance of when you're making an animated film, of course you'd like to make money, but you also want to make a good film. And also to appeal to maybe your audience of a child, you have to be entertaining. But there's also the struggle of making a good film as well that you can be proud of.
I mean, I think that's such an interesting question. Hollywood notoriously, and America something, you know, you can tell from my accent I'm not from El Paso, right?
Yes.
So I'm a Brit, right? We know that. So we... I love this country, and I'm now a US citizen and very proud to be so. But there's something about commerce here, capitalism here. I once ventured to tell somebody at an executive meeting at one of the major studios on a Monday morning when we were talking about the films that had opened, and I didn't like a film particularly I went to see. And the response was, "What do you mean you didn't like it? It was number one at the box office." And suddenly realizing, you know, a big part of success, if not the main part of success, is based on its profitability. People liked it, they went to see it, and they bought a movie ticket. That's success. I come from a bit more of an art house background in the theater, and it can be worthy, but not successful. That doesn't exist here. What has happened, to answer your question, is because I think there are some very fine movies being made. We have more filmmakers making films in animation. 20 years ago, one film every 3 or 4 years. This past year, there were 20 animated feature films, with some people saying too many. No. There were hundreds of live-action films made last year, 300-400. It's a tiny percentage. There's plenty of room in the marketplace. You start to see different types of films. Waltz with Bashir 2 years ago, you know, tackling different subjects. But one of the things that's happened with Pixar is this continued and ongoing success. And when you become successful as a filmmaker, you can start to make more dangerous choices. They're not really dangerous. They're just considered to be dangerous by executives who look at formulas. WALL-E broke a formula. They don't talk for much of the movie, you know? It's an empty film in terms of what you would normally, you know, populate a film with. So it's allowed a freedom to come in there. So John Lasseter has protected so fiercely and allowed the artists to make films and make choices, and I think that's a big part of it. If you start to get some failures, then all of that gets shut down. So then, particularly in the lead, I think for my company and what I'm trying to pioneer in the space that I'm working in is that we can make these films for less money. Now, at DreamWorks and you know, Pixar, Disney, Fox to some extent, at Blue Sky, their films are well over $100 million, if not closer to $200 million. Wildly expensive, they're incredible sandboxes, they're so sophisticated, they make beautiful films. I believe, like in live action, you could make films in the independent model. Not have to have your own permanent studio, put together teams, because of course the technology, look at the technology we're using now, you know, the idea that we could do something like this just 5 years ago would have been impossible. Now we can all be broadcasters, we can all be filmmakers. It's now about talent, it's not about equipment. It used to be about equipment. When I first started doing CGI work, I was buying SGIs on behalf of Disney. I was very popular with all sorts of massive companies because I was buying them at $250,000 each, plus let alone the software that I was going to load on it, most of which would have to be developed in-house and be proprietary. So you had these massive prices of entry. Well, the price of entry has disappeared. It's disappeared for live action guys. You no longer need film stock. I mean, film schools, the big thing was the cost of film and processing and everything like that. Now, digital camera. Now it's about the filmmaker, not about the technology. And that's in every single part of our lives. Doesn't change the underlying talent, whether you're writing a book or making a movie or anything we do in our lives. The technology still needs to be used. And if it's used by somebody who's skilled, they'll make something great. But the technology is not going to do anything for them. It's not going to make a great film on its own. So that's my very long answer to that very good question. So
that's great. Well, last question. Your company, Exodus Film Group, has a number of projects coming online, I assume, in the near future. If you can talk about those,
yeah.
What's coming online?
Well, I can. Let me, first of all, set up by a guy called John Iraklis, who had the idea there could be a film fund for animation, which I thought was really smart. It's not, there have been film funds in live action, but you get investors and you say to them, okay, there are three films in the film fund, and you're going to cross all the revenues and losses, if there are, you know, but you have a better chance of, so it made it very, very attractive. And we have three films. We've done one, which was Igor, which is a fantastic cast, very off the wall. We made it in Paris and Vietnam, had a lot of fantastic ex-Disney animators who really were the senior leadership of the film. And then we made a lot of it with a new studio in Vietnam, in Ho Chi Minh City, and trained another group of... It's another great thing about animation. The international language of animation is so fantastic because it's art. If you don't understand language, you draw something, right? Mm-hmm. It was a very, very rewarding experience. We have two more films. We have Bunyan and Babe, classic, which is starring John Goodman, Kelsey Grammer, and Jeff Foxworthy. A character I didn't know, right? Paul Bunyan is an American folk hero, mm-hmm. not British, right? Yeah. So I've already said Paul Bunyan. I went, oh yeah, I nodded away, and they know when I just nod away. They haven't got a clue. So what I found it. But anyway, that's a really interesting story, clever idea about him coming back in today's world, really, and sort of helping a young kid, you know, save the grandparents' farm from a developer, but just reminding us of, I think, you know, on the basis of how America, you know, pioneer spirit of America and what it meant, you know, hard work, good people who give to each other and their community and fend off people who come in and exploit. So I think it's a good message in today's world. And then the other one is The Hero of Color City, which is about a box of crayons that come to life. And I like it because it's art-based, but it takes the idea that the crayons, which is not a new idea, it's been used in Toy Story and many other films before that, because it's in every child's imagination, is what's the toys in their bedroom or in their world are alive. Kids have imaginary friends and their toys, they breathe life into them as they play with them. So it's taking that concept. But the crayons, when the little boy falls asleep at night, go home. They go over to Color City and they color. They sketch away and they get refinished. They go to the spa and they get repaired. And what something goes wrong, an unfinished drawing gets in and creates havoc, and there's a great standoff, and nearly all of Color City nearly collapses, and they nearly don't get back in the morning, and if they're not back in their places when the little boy wakes up, they can never go back. But what we discover is the unfinished drawing just needed to be finished, and he didn't have a mouth. And so I love the message of this film because it teaches us, and it's designed for very young kids. It's designed for a film that, you know, kids maybe the first film that they'll see. But it's the message in there is just because we don't understand something doesn't mean to say it's bad. And that's the realization of one of the crayons that realizes the drawing just needed to be finished. And once the drawing has a voice, we can all understand and communicate, even if we come from different places. It's about communication and talking and open dialogue. So I love that. That message. And anyway, the alarm bell goes and they just get back into position before the little boy wakes up. And hey, I'm pitching my film on this. And anyway, before the little boy wakes up. And of course, when he does wake up, we're going very close with the camera. And we give you that feeling that he's dreamt the whole thing. So he goes running over to the drawing to finish it. And when he picks up the drawing's finished, of course. And then one of the crayons that he can't see just winks into the camera, and it's the end of the movie. It's very, very, very sweet. Christina Ricci, Rosie Perez, Arsenio Hall, and Craig Ferguson. So a marvellous mix. Yes, yeah, but, you know, the great Scottish comedian. He has the late night shows. Very very funny. He's also in How to Train Your Dragon. You know, the very good DreamWorks picture that's just opened and doing very well. So that's Exodus.
All right, excellent. Can't wait to see those. Again, Mr. Howard, thank you for coming. He's the president of Exodus Film Group, and I appreciate you talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Cougar Cast. This podcast was produced by Nick Young and Mark Robinson. For more information on the Cougar Cast, to listen to previous episodes, and to subscribe to future shows, visit www.colin.edu/podcasts. For more news from around the college, visit www.colin.edu/news. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the Cougar Cast, please send me an email at nyoung@colin.edu. Thanks for listening.